when we come to these questions, which I think are the most important questions of our time, right? The rise of kleptocrats around the world, authoritarian kleptocrats, how they're forming alliances, how they are knitted together with the Western corporate interests. These are the questions that are shaping all our lives. These are the questions that have brought us to war in Ukraine. And yet they are the hardest questions to report on for the media today because of the sheer power of what you might call the censorship industry, lawyers, PRs, and so on, hugely outgunned the media.
Hello and welcome to Kickback, the Global Anti-Corruption Podcast. This episode features Tom Burgess, who is the author of several books on corruption, and talks to Liz Davidbarrett about his latest, Cuckoo Land, Where the Rich Own the Truth. This is a great episode as Tom explains how he goes about researching these books and the obstacles he faces. Tom particularly talks about how kleptocratic actors exploit Western legal systems to prevent scrutiny, which opens up some really interesting questions around which institutions are the protectors of the truth. We hope you enjoy the episode and thank you for listening.
Hi, everybody. I'm Liz Davidbarrett, and welcome to Kickback, the Global Anti-Corruption Podcast. I am delighted to be joined today by investigative journalist Tom Burgess, who is the author of a new book called Cuckoo Land, Where the Rich Own the Truth. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Liz. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited to be able to talk about the book. It's in fact not your first book about corruption, Tom. So I wondered if we could just start off with you telling us a bit about how you got interested in this topic, what your background is, you know, what's the journey that brought you here?
Well, depends how far back you want to go. I think that the really big moment for me was in 2010 when I was the West Africa correspondent for the Financial Times. And on the one hand, I was covering what the big oil companies get up to in Africa and big mining companies and the way that they frequently pay enormous bribes in very clever ways to get hold of the raw ingredients of the global economy for which their executives are so handsomely rewarded. And on the other hand, I was covering the violence that is so endemic in West Africa. And there was one day when I covered a particularly awful massacre in a village in central Nigeria. And like everybody else, I wrote this up with the usual terminology about religious strife, ethnic hatreds, and so on. And there was religious strife and there was ethnic hatred. But I became really obsessed with what had happened there and tried to really get to the bottom of it. And ultimately, where I arrived, and this was really the heart of my first book called The Looting Machine, was that the engine of so much violence that is often sort of dismissed in a kind of typically casually racist way as somehow inherent to African people, at the heart of it is corruption that is, in many instances, transnational or global, certainly involves Western commercial interests and consumers. And in that instance, in that village, what you could see was that because the whole of Nigerian politics has become a race to secure access to the oil money, which is largely the only real alternative to extreme poverty, people will do anything to secure even one little local capillary of that oil money.
Mm-hmm.
And that means politics becomes about the purpose of politics becomes self-enrichment. This isn't politics to steward a collective interest. It's to weaponize any part of humanity that you can, ethnic feeling, religious sentiment, to the most violent extremes in order to secure yourself a power base and access to that pot of wealth. And that understanding of corruption, I then carry into my next book, the second one, it's called Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. And because after my years in Africa, I went to the former Soviet Union and lots of other places and started to see this phenomenon that lots of other people have talked about too, of the rise of kleptocracy, really since the end of the Cold War, this kind of monster that capitalism created, a globalized capitalism created, which was at the very pinnacles of power around the world, Beijing, Moscow, and with Donald Trump, Washington. The same phenomenon I witnessed in Nigeria, which is to capture power, to corruptly enrich yourself and your followers, and use that power to maintain that wealth. It's been called very well by Ricardo Suarez de Oliveira, a brilliant writer on these subjects. It's been called the privatization of power. That's a very good way of understanding it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that absolutely resonates what you said there about, you know, it sort of gets dressed up sometimes with ideology and with language around, you know, ethnic conflict. But actually, that's just a kind of addressing or a way of weaponizing it. Ultimately, the purpose is about looting and stealing money.
Yeah. And it's that final stage of, you could call that one, the privatization of reality itself, of this shift into capturing the ultimate prize, actually, which is control over the truth, over reality. That step into that ultimate stage, that is the subject of this third book, Cuckoo Land.
Yeah, great. So that's a great segue into Cuckoo Land. So tell us about this book. What's it all about? Why is it called Cuckoo Land?
Well, so part of the Kleptopia was about some oligarchs, and that their company sued me over the book. And so during the pandemic, I was spending a lot of time talking to lawyers and then in the High Court. And we won that case resoundingly. And the book is still on the bookshelves, despite the wishes of these oligarchs. But at the same time, I heard in early, would have been 2021, that there was another case going on, but in secret, where a very rich businessman who had given a lot of money to the Conservative Party had hired first Mishkon de Rea and then Carter Rock, two names that are not as well known as they should be outside circles of journalism, incredibly powerful law firms that do what's called reputation management, which essentially means writing lots of threatening letters to anyone who offers a version of reality that their clients don't like. And what had happened in this case was that this rich Tory donor, Mohammed Amersi, had decided that a memo that had been written by a former MP was an outrageous slur on his character. And it was Carter Ruck who wrote many, 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 many letters to this former MP, Charlotte Leslie. What Charlotte Leslie had done, her offence in Mr. Amersi's eyes, was she had raised some questions about his past. She works these days, not just on MP, she works on the kind of Conservative Party liaison with the Middle East. So important stuff, right? The kind of stuff that gets you in the room with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, Sisi, Abbas, and so on. And Amersi wanted to move into that world. So she did some checks, as she would say, in good faith, circulated a memo, raising a few questions about him, as she would say in a witness statement, raising what she thought were gaps between what he said and reality, and pointing to things like how he'd made some money in Russia and so on. And so I did two things. One was I tried to follow this extraordinary case, which ended up in the High Court, going on for years and years and years, because I think that in itself is hugely important, actually, that there are law firms and their extremely wealthy clients who have massive influence over the public record, over what we get to read, and much more importantly, what we don't get to read. And secondly, I thought, if someone has been so outraged by a few fairly rudimentary questions about their past, what is that past, I wonder? And so off I went. You know, some of that past was to be found in Mayfair. Some of it was a Royal Scottish retreat. Some of it was in Scandinavia. Some of it was in Vladimir Putin's St. Petersburg. I couldn't go back to Russia because the war had started by then. Some of it was in another place I spent a lot of time, Kazakhstan. Some of it was in Kathmandu, where I spent several days. And what unites all these things is Mr. Mercy's business career, when he was a consultant on deals, on huge transnational deals in the information industry, in the telecoms industry. And he would tell us, if he were here, very possibly in some of the colourful young language he's used in the past, that all these deals were absolutely legit, that lots of bankers and lawyers worked on them, and that every penny he's ever made is completely squeaky clean. But what he does accept is that he's doing all of these deals in countries that have huge corruption problems, that are blighted by corruption. I mean, it made me think back to Nigeria, places where the most unfortunate thing that happens to anyone there is to be born in a place where the purpose of power is to enrich those who hold it. The purpose of power is to benefit those who hold it, not those in whose name they hold it. So I tried to understand that whole story. And really all this book is an attempt to tell one story of one man properly. And in doing so, maybe show the truth about that story, but also how hard it is to do. And how, when we come to these questions, which I think are the most important questions of our time, right? The rise of kleptocrats around the world, authoritarian kleptocrats, how they're forming alliances, how they are knitted together with the Western corporate interests. These are the questions that are shaping all our lives. These are the questions that have brought us to war in Ukraine. And yet they are the hardest questions to report on for the media today, because of the sheer power of what you might call the censorship industry, lawyers, PRs, and so on, hugely outgun the media. So there'll be certain oligarchs who are completely off limits to certain publications. There'll be certain journalists who get a reputation as being unproductive or expensive because they're trying to cover this stuff. And there's just a general terror in an increasingly cash-strapped media industry of the millions and millions and millions you could be on the hook for if these things end in court. And the result of that is when we need more than ever to be reporting on, scrutinizing and understanding the mega rich, the authoritarian kleptocrats, the oligarchs, we're severely hampered and often censor ourselves from doing that.
Yeah, and I mean, I'd really like to talk about that. Maybe just to take a small step back first, and if you could just tell us a bit about how you go about researching a book like this. You know, as you say, it's many different countries. It's some, you know, it covers the British royal family and ruling party. It covers Central Asian dictatorships and family members. It covers international bribery cases with big corporates. How much, you know, what kind of sources are you using to go after that? How much of it is open? How do you set up interviews around that kind of thing? So quite a lot of the book is around, you know, this one-on-one interview that you're having with the central figure. And a lot of that is excruciatingly difficult to read, actually, because it's very sort of confrontational, particularly the way that, you know, he reacts to your questions. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, how you do that research?
Well, there's a I think this is probably a family friendly podcast, isn't it? So I won't quote some of the toothier language, the saltier language. But really, you just start with a beachhead. So you start with a question. You start with, for instance, okay, here's someone we can establish from basic checks of public records, an outline. So here are, let's say, here is hints or glimpses of business activities in places where business activities are difficult to conduct in a clean way. Former Soviet Union being, and then you start source work, which is people you know already, and trying to get them to pass you to people you know more. And you start sort of build from this beachhead of fact. You build out step by step, trying to get from one source to the next. It's important to go and meet people in person. It's important to build trust with people. It's important to try and constantly interrogate your own thesis. Imagine that you're always assume that you're wrong, you've misunderstood, to try and come up things backwards. And then as that process goes along, I mean, there's obviously the managing risk. Okay, so it's obviously you have to, in some cases, go to, I was covering some stuff in Ukraine and Africa at the same time, not related to this book, but you're always trying to manage your own safety and, more importantly, the safety of your sources, their anonymity, their physical safety, their well-being. So there's all of that process, which is just sort of the day-to-day work of investigative journalism. And then that all builds to saying, well, I think I've got an understanding of this story that I'm working on. I just think I've got an understanding of these business deals, of these political donations and so on. And then you go through fact-checking. Right? So you say, Liz, I've been reporting for 3 years, and I'm pretty sure that pretty convinced that you like marmalade, not jam on your toast. But can I just check with you, please, if that's correct? And this is all part of the reporting. I mean, often these days, this sadly is mediated through law firms. Mm-hmm. But what happened with Mohammed Owaisi was that he said, okay, we'll talk. I will give you a hell of a lot of documents and I will speak to you. I mean, he ended up largely shouting at me, but it's all, you know, he said what he wanted to say. He gave me a lot of written material, a lot of documents for me to digest and understand. And then the task is to try to reflect 3 years of information accurately and fairly in a book, and crucially in a book that people might actually want to read. Mm-hmm. So investigative journalism often leads to sites of storytelling, but I think I'm now on book three. I'm finally starting, I hope you found, and that others find, to do this very difficult thing, which is take reporting that often get is often in far-flung places with people with names we've never heard of, mm-hmm. you know, layer upon layer of shell companies and often deliberately complex corporate structures and money going here and money going there, and try to get through that to the human beings and tell the real story in a way that keeps people turning the pages, because all the great reporting in the world is useless if no one's ever going to read it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you do a great job of that, of building up these very colourful characters, many of them actually at the beginning. And, you know, there was a point where I was wondering, so where's this all going? And then sort of gradually these...
Literally, you threw the book out of the window and decided...
No, because I was hooked, actually, because there were plenty of little hooks there.
It is an utterly gripping story, this, I must say. Like,
yeah.
I haven't got to the end of the book and thought, oh, God, that's over. I found the subject, the individual himself, and the other characters in the story, Charlotte Leslie and Ben Elliott and so on, utterly compelling, because they're moving in this world where, I think, dramatizes what a lot of us experience in various ways in our ordinary lives these days, which is a sense that the truth has lost its guardians or its champions, maybe. That maybe for a long time we assumed, perhaps naively, that the truth is arrived at pretty much in good faith. And there's a kind of public square where anyone is entitled to hash it out and get to, you know, an honest assessment of someone's character, of the conduct of a business, of a political project. But actually, I think increasingly we feel, and it's a combination of technological change and social media, but also the collapse of the traditional media and so on, that this is that actually we're entering a sort of feudal reality again, where reality is what those with the most power say it is. I think that's why this work is so fascinating. What I think hope comes across in the book is that this slightly nauseating feeling that the truth is what we're told it is, not what we collectively establish.
Yeah, and that we have this sort of idea about rule of law as providing the truth, but the reality actually of how, you know, legal interactions work is often that, you know, those who can pay for the most expensive lawyers actually get to say what the truth is, rather than there being a kind of standard.
Well, but I think that's so important, because actually the thing through all three of these books, and especially in Cookerland, is the question of the law.
Mm.
But in Kleptopia, there was a section about how the law worked in Nazi Germany. In Cookerland, there's stuff about arbitration proceedings, you know, the private courts in which the rich and multinational corporations settle their differences without mm-hmm. any open justice. And
yep.
And Cookerland, the point I think we arrive at with the law is that the law is... We think of it as our system for apportioning guilt and justice, but ultimately the law is our ultimate mechanism for fact finding, for establishing truth. We have, you know, discussions between individuals. We have the media, and then we have the law. And when the stakes are high enough, we have the courts, and we have the system of juries or civil courts and appeals and so on, honed over centuries, to get us to something that can credibly, with a consensus, be called the truth. And I think part of what's happening here that hasn't been scrutinized so much is the breakdown of the institution of the law as the arbiter of truth. And part of that is to do with the entanglement of the UK's legal system with kleptocratic legal systems, which aren't, of course, legal systems at all. They're just holograms of that. So all these long years of oligarchs suing journalists or battling each other in the London courts has created vast fees for a generation of lawyers and law firms. And you often get situations where evidence produced, you know, which can pretty convincingly be said to have been produced under torture in, let's say, Russia or Kazakhstan, is being supplied for use in UK, often civil proceedings. And you get and there are lots of instances of, you know, incredibly august law firms on behalf of clients who would consider themselves gold standard visionary Davos going entrepreneurs rather than, you know, crooked oligarchs perjuring themselves of, you see again and again, situations where very rich and powerful people represented by big law firms submitting evidence, huge, huge quantities of evidence and witness statements. And the judge will say, a judge will query something. And then, you know, a witness statement presenting completely the alternative set of facts will arrive saying, okay, well, actually this is what we're doing. And even lawyers in this world who have made life-changing amounts of money representing these clients, if you take them for a coffee or a glass of wine, they will say, yeah, there used to be a disincentive to lie to the court because of, let's say, cases like Jonathan Aitken, you know. Even in the civil courts, you lie, you can end up going to prison. But lying to the court, perjury, which goes to the absolute heart of a free society, right? If lying to a court, lying to the arbiter of truth, is no longer punishable, practically. Then that is a real part of the breakdown of having an idea of truth, without which you can't really have a free society based on trust. And you just got overburdened, underfunded courts and judges who don't want the difficulty of saying, I think that such and such an oligarch has clearly lied. They might say in their judgment, I found him unconvincing. But again and again, you hear of instances where the courts have been abused and lied to, and there is no consequence for.
And you talk in the book quite explicitly about the risk of being sued by people that you're writing about in the book. In fact, there's a really
I talk about on podcasts. I mean, but repeatedly, I've had letters saying you said such and such a thing on such a podcast. I mean, it is the reality of the journey.
We look forward to that.
Yeah, sorry about that, but it is the reality that people just trying to go about the basics of journalism, in some cases, face conditions similar to those you experience in covering, let's say, the former Soviet Union. Now, you're not at risk in the UK of being slung in a dungeon and dying, being bumped off on the streets, although obviously Russians have been. But the point really is about the public record, whether the public record reflects reality. And there are, you know, I've been to Kazakhstan and documented how torture was used to produce confessions for show trials after a massacre of protesters. And that's how the public record is falsified there. In the UK, what happens is the law is used, the threat of the law. I mean, I've had a situation where I wrote about some oligarchs, and in a legal letter, they casually, one of their companies casually revealed surveillance had been used in central London under the National Theatre. It happens in the National Theatre car. I mean, so there is this constant threat. Yep, Mohamed Morsi repeatedly and in no uncertain terms that you maybe wouldn't want your mother to hear, threatened to sue me. He's said all sorts of things about me. I've had, and many, many other journalists I know have had, public filings made against us in courts. In other cases, we've been accused of being on the take, being bent, being corrupt, being paid off. This is not meant to be a sob story, because the real courage and the real suffering is undergone by the people who show real courage, and the people who undergo real suffering are sources who will never receive any recognition. But I say this because I think it's quite important to understand the techniques that are being used if we want our journalists to provide us with honest, well-reported information about these most important questions.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a big personal risk, it seems. And yeah, again, difficult to imagine how you deal with that.
Well, I mean, but what's sort of slightly crackers about all of this? I mean, as anyone who's seen Succession or White Lotus, or The Death of Stalin will know or read these, there's lots of fantastic novels grappling with these questions. Trust by Hernán Díaz is magnificent, about, you know, the rich being able to control reality. Zadie Smith's new one, Fraud is very good. Naomi Klein's book, Doppelganger. We're all grappling with these questions of reality. All of these books are. But what you often see, and that's why I mentioned Succession and White Lotus and so on, is that there's a lot of fear in these in this area, because a lot of this money links back to places that are terrifying, and where to do journalism, for instance, in Russia, can be fatal. The reason I mentioned Succession and White Lotus and so on is that actually what you find on closer inspection is that the world of the very, very rich and powerful is absolutely hilarious. And quite a lot of the reviews of Cuckoo Land, I was pleased to say, have picked up on this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd see where I used to work, not known for its necessarily for side-splitting sense of humour, said it was savagely funny. And I think this is the case, and I think it's very important. And, you know, people like Jesse Armstrong and Amanda Iannucci, and the satire of the rich is really important, of the rich and the powerful, because it's a form of resistance in one way, but also I think it brings out how often the pettiness of what's being argued over, and just the absolute enraged demand to that red be blue and blue be red, and when the whole basis of your power and standing is called into question, not through and what follows is not a kind of honest debate about yes, maybe this deal was like that, or maybe this deal was like this. It's an absolute insistence, not necessarily often even about the facts, but about whether there should be scrutiny. I mean,
yeah,
the number of
letters
I've received that have essentially started from the premise of, like, it's just an affront that you would consider who are you to even consider looking at me, and just the idea that there could be good faith journalism just trying to scrutinize the exercise of power.
Yes, something that we often see with grand corruption and with instances of state capture is that there is this resistance to scrutiny, and then often comes with closing down institutions whose function is about oversight. But of course, what you're talking about in this book is much more about the use of the courts to change what in fact is seen as the truth.
Well, very true. And it goes to this bigger question of just the term we used earlier, the privatization of power, just this widening phenomenon of power being something that's owned by those who hold it. It's rightly used in service of those who hold it. You know, Trump absolutely embodies that idea. A man who was a completely failed businessman, and then managed to invent himself as a TV character, sort of ersatz business genius, who could then rent out his name for money from the former Soviet Union to improve its image, and is then doing what, you know, it's sort of, for those of us who have covered elections in, let's say, the global south, places like West Africa, the idea that you would run for office to try to protect yourself from criminal prosecution is not weird. In fact, that's
absolutely
what's happening.
Yeah,
that's kind of standard, and it's a sort of race. Well, someone's going to get immunity from prosecution, and someone's going to jail. Those are the consequences of electoral success or failure, and that's what this is. What Trump's doing is, as we speak, and clearly an enormous engine of disinformation and the disruption of reality himself, quite skillfully. With people like Bannon around him. So Cuckoo Land is the story, extraordinary story of really one man. But I think it shows us something quite profound about the state of power in the world today, that if reality becomes the tool of the powerful, then you can't have a free society. And I think we are hurtling towards that. Quite a terrifying speed. There's a technological aspect to it too, but it's also that Trump, Putin, and so on are capitalizing on the weakness of the institutions that are meant to safeguard the truth, and gathering power into themselves as a result.
Completely. So, you know, at the center of the study of corruption, we're often examining this problem, but also examining what's happening in the anti-corruption policy space. Do you, I mean, given your work in this area, do you have any sort of reflections on how we're doing in the fight against global corruption? Do you think we're making progress in some areas, or is it all bleak?
Well, I mean, I'd be interested to know what you think, actually. But the I think that the when I was in West Africa, corruption was regarded as something, I mean, broadly speaking, corruption was regarded as something that brown people and black people did. A long way away. Mm-hmm. And it was when I was there that you started to get those huge scandals coming through, not necessarily all in Africa at all, but BAE in Saudi Arabia, Siemens in Africa, Halliburton, KBR in Iraq, and so on. And you started to see, I think, the way that corruption had gone global, and that it takes two to tango. And so you started to get, I think a shift in perception that a lot of brilliant people, the Center for the Study of Corruption, of Corruption included, have profoundly deepened our understanding of two things. One, of the way that corruption is at the heart of why failed states fail all over the world, and the huge cost of that. Mm. And the other one is the extent to which corruption just sort of doesn't happen in corrupt countries. These are, every big bribery scandal is an international network that connects generally countries where someone where there is raw materials to extract. So that would typically be a poor country as a result. The big financial centres, big Western political figures who can act as lobbyists or burnish the reputation of multinational corporations. Those multinational corporations, the corporations themselves, hedge funds behind them, the big pension funds behind them, and so on. And these networks interlinked with political power are what generates corruption. So it's not a case of there being a sort of a clean world versus a dirty world, yep, geographically, if you like, which I think is what used to be the assumption. And I think the invasion of Ukraine has really turbocharged that, because you start to see the consequence of cozying up for Putin in exchange for a share of the loot, essentially, which is what certainly London has done for decades. Yeah. And that's now bitten us. And the extraordinary, the way the politicians were falling over themselves to denounce this kind of horrific kleptocrat and all his loot, which 3 days earlier they'd be quite happy to welcome into their political parties.
Sure. Yeah.
And surely the danger is with all of this is that even though certainly in the UK, anti-corruption legislation has improved a lot, right? Unexplained wealth orders, new Economic Crime Act, and so on. I like Ben Judah's phrase about this, about a hologram state, that the statutes are great, mm-hmm, but the institutions are supposed to use these tools, like the Serious Fraud Office especially, mm-hmm, are completely under-resourced, demoralised, hollowed out, and in some stages acting with appalling misconduct themselves. And these are supposed to be the front line of our defences, not just against fraud or indeed bribery, but against this rising of international networks of authoritarian kleptocrats. These alliances that are being formed between kleptocrats with different faces, you know, ones with a socialist face in Venezuela, ones with an Islamist face in Iran, ones with a nationalist face in the Kremlin, and one with a sort of, I don't know, clown hat on in Pyongyang. But they all allied, all conducting trade, business activities, illicit finance together, military cooperation. Our institutions of law are the defence against this. And they are crumbling.
Yep, and under threat, yeah. Tom, we need to finish up, but we always ask people, you know, what would you encourage academic researchers to look at or to work on? So I wonder if I could ask you to address that, but also really curious to know if you have plans for your next book.
Oh, right. Well, I'll come to the next book. I feel that I rely greatly on brilliant work by academic researchers. I would state before, I would suggest that they follow their brilliant and very well trained noses. But I would say that and send us all the results to read. But I would also say that this connection between national security and kleptocracy is really, really important. I think senior members of the current UK government, the Conservative Party, and people around the apparently incoming Labour government get this. People around Biden clearly understand this too. it's not a coincidence that someone like Navalny, who Putin regards as his greatest threat, so much so that he's now dead, was targeting corruption. It's always the way. The corruption is the heart of things. And I think making that link, whereas for a long time, it was a sort of moral argument against corruption, that it's really bad for poor people, which of course it is. And it remains so, and that is no less important. But in order to get rich countries to respond in policy terms, I think it helps to make this argument that Ukraine demonstrates so terribly that harboring, permitting, being complicit in corruption rots your own institutions. I mean, look at the money that's come into the. Just to take the UK again, the UK's parliament, media, legal system, and the effect, the corrosive effect that money is having. And I think in that area, and that's, I think, relatively underexplored still. Some brilliant people work on it, obviously. But I think very, very important, especially as the kleptocrats of the world get more assertive and more expansive. And the next book, I mean, I write in the acknowledgement of the current one about how I keep, my wife is still with me, even though I keep saying terrible things like, I've got another book. And when I do so, she makes a noise like, she's wonderful. So I don't know. I think the best way to do these things, I'm spending some time in Ukraine. I think that's just critical. I think the potential fall of the US Republic could be upon us. I mean, the stakes are massive. But I like Martin Amis's expression. He talks about a donné, something given by the universe. Really, that is how it works, that one day the idea comes into your head. And if it's not like that, I mean, that's kind of a result of knowing lots of sources and going to lots of places and so on. But you sort of have to wait for that, because that's when an honest story. I think, to quote, I think, Francis Bacon, that's when the clay is telling you what it wants to be.
That's nice.
So yes, that's a rubbish answer to your question, but
not at all. It's great. Yeah, and we look forward to it, whatever it will be. Also, thanks for all the other tips of things to read and watch that came up during the course of the conversation. So it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. It's been a delight.